Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here bright and early on a sunny Monday morning. So we have a number of things that we're going to be doing today. We're going to first start with work sessions for introduction of a committee measure, and also we have a SB 303, which we're going to be moving from our committee and moving it to back to the president to be reassigned, because it needs to go into the whatever we're calling the Joint Marijuana Committee 91 implementation, because it has a lot of contacts and information that they've been working on, so they wanted to do it together, and so that's what we'll be doing. Then we're going to also have our public hearings on SB 64 and 65, and we also have one on Senate Bill 247. And what we're going to do is go ahead and start with opening with the work session, and this is going to be for the introduction of committee measures. And Senator Thatcher, did you get a script for this?
Well, I do, but no, it's fine. Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concept that I haven't had a chance yet to look at be introduced as a committee bill. It is LC 2432, dated 12/7/16.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves the introduction of LC 2432, dated 12/7/2016, to be introduced as a committee bill. Our qualifying statement, just to make our disclaimer, a vote in favor of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of how the members' opinion or positions will be on that bill in the future, and it also doesn't mean that we, the Judiciary Committee, will actually get it, because it will be something that will be go through the process through the President's office. With that said, as a disclaimer, is there any other discussion regarding the motion to introduce LC 2432 as a committee measure?
Well, yes, sir. What is it?
All right. So we will ask our my lifeline to my right, Josh. Oh, boy.
One sec.
I think we stumped him.
Uh-oh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC 2432 does one simple thing. It, in the context of mandatory revocation of driver's license, the LC changes a shall to a may. So it gives the court discretion in terms of revoking the driver's license of a person convicted of felony driving while under the influence.
Okay. So any other discussions or comments on the motion? Any objection to the motion as it's been presented? Not seeing any, so ordered. It's now will be a committee measure, and we'll sign the paperwork later. And then we're going to, while we're in the work session, we're going to go ahead and go to Senate Bill 303. And Josh, if you can just tell us what this is and why we're moving it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 303 modifies the statutes related to the purchase and possession of alcohol and marijuana by minors. The bill also increases the penalties for possession of a marijuana item by a minor who is operating a motor vehicle. And we do, in fact, have the paperwork necessary to move the bill.
All right. And so I think that also has a maybe even more of a special script.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 303 be moved without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulation.
Senator Thatcher moves that we Senate Bill 303 be moved without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulations. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And that will take care of the work sessions that we have at this point. We're going to go ahead and close the work sessions. And my understanding, we're going to look at public hearings as to who we have here. And I do not see your members.
No.
So we're going to go ahead and start with the top of the list, 64.
Sure.
All right, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 64. Josh, if you can give us the preview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, give me 1 second. Senate Bill 64 replaces the term mental disease or defect with the term qualifying psychiatric or developmental condition for purposes of the diminished capacity defense, the guilty except for insanity plea, and jurisdiction over persons found guilty except for insanity. The bill authorizes the Psychiatric Security Review Board to adopt rules defining the term and exclude specified abnormalities from its scope. The introduced bill also modifies additional terminology in PSRB-related statutes. That being said, for purposes of the public hearing today, there are two amendments before the committee. Both amendments replace the measure in its entirety. They are, in fact, complementary. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the term mental disease or defect with the term mental disorder. And the dash 2 amendment modifies the scope of mental disease or defect by expressly excluding specified abnormalities. And the dash 2 amendment also applies these changes prospectively. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I have at this point five individuals that have signed up. Unfortunately, three of those individuals have not said what the position they're taking. I prefer knowing so we can kind of just group people together. So, Juliet, I'm assuming you're here in support?
Yes, Chair.
All right, and then Harris, support or opposing?
Opposing.
All right, and then Gail, opposing or support? Holistic, a little of everything? All right, so we'll let you do some reading on that. And so what I'm going to ask is Juliet and Bob Duntoff, why don't you two come up first since y'all are on the supporting side, and then we'll come in with the those opposing and the other one who's not sure yet. Thank you. Whoever would like to lead off, if you'll give us your name and your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chairman Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senators Denbrough, Lithicum, and Manning. Thank you for this opportunity to let me speak to you. My name is Juliet Britton. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board.
All right, one thing before we get going, I have a couple new members. I just want everyone to know this today is only going to be public hearings. We are not going to be moving the bills today. One, we don't have all the paperwork, and number two, it's very early to be moving stuff. We just got amendments on. We'll be working at that endeavor further down in the session. All right. I'm sorry, Juliet.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 64 will do two things. First, it will replace derogatory statutory language in our code, currently mental disease or defect, applicable to those living with mental illness and intellectual disabilities. Senate Bill 64 also clarifies the current definition of mental disease or defect by having the complete definition in one place in the statute, including case law. This bill does not seek to create a new definition of mental disease or defect as it's been applied for the last 40 years. For the mental disease and defect renaming portion of this bill, the board believes and has received feedback from stakeholders that the phrase mental disease or defect is offensive. Stakeholders have also indicated, and the board agrees, that the word defect in particular is derogatory. And this language has existed since the late 1970s. The board vetted this bill with its legislative stakeholder group, and we agree that using the clinical terms directly from the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, also called the DSM, is the most appropriate language to replace mental disease or defect. It satisfies the needs of prosecutors and the defense bar, as well as the evaluators and clinicians who are providing the courts and PSRB with medical opinions on diagnoses. The second portion of the bill would incorporate case law and clarify the qualifying conditions for those defendants who want to assert guilty except for insanity, also called GEI. Currently, ORS 161-295, subsection 2, defines mental disease or defect, but it doesn't define it in its entirety. It fails to include drug-induced psychosis and drug addiction, as well as sexual conduct disorders. And our hope is that with this dash 2 amendment that we could include those definitions so it's in one place. This is the portion of the statute where our clinicians and certified evaluators who are assisting the courts and judges are looking to in the code when they're looking what qualifies as a mental disease or defect. I recognize that the dash 2 amendments just came on board with some of our stakeholders, so we might need some more time to finesse the language a little bit, and we have no objection to getting this to a working dash 3 amendment where we have consensus. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Bob?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundev. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I'd like to thank the PSRB for inviting me to be in a work group that worked on developing Senate Bill 64. We do support the bill and the amendments that have been put forward. Our interest is in bringing the language in statute up to modern standards. We've actually done this in a variety of other areas of law, and the problem that is posed is really part of being a disability rights advocate, is that some of the language that we use is a holdover from earlier days in which conceptions of disability were different and they have changed over time. probably one of the bedrocks of disability rights, of the Americans with Disabilities Act and other civil rights laws for people with disabilities, is trying to move the public perception away from the idea that people with disabilities are in some manner defective or incomplete human beings to a recognition that disability is part, a normal part of life. There's been people with disabilities with us forever and most likely forever in the future. And so what we would like is to have the language in our laws reflect that. And Senate Bill 64 is one step in that direction. As was noted, the term defect is particularly offensive to people that I work with because, it assumes that there are regular human beings and then there are defective human beings rather than the fact that we're all human beings. We have no interest whatsoever in changing the underlying law in this area. We think there are provisions that have been written into the bill and the amendments that state explicitly that the intent of this legislation is not to change any of the case law, not to change the statutory interpretations of terminology in the law, and as such, we are very supportive.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Thatcher first.
Excuse me. Maybe you can clarify for me what it means to allow the board to come up with definitions if we're not changing definitions. I'm not tracking on that one.
Chairman Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, that was the original bill language. That's been removed in the dash two.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Senator Manning.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question. Now, I'm not saying whether or not I am opposed or in support of, but I do know that the term mental illness is thrown out there quite frequently. Yesterday, I did a with St. Vincent de Paul, where they were working on building, raising money for homeless veterans. And one of the pieces of paper that they gave me suggestive language had veterans returning with mental illness. I did not use that word mental illness, and I challenge that because I don't believe veterans are charged with mental illness. If they had mental illness, then they wouldn't go into the military. So I'm interested to see how this thing progresses on. I think that it's easy to label people with as mentally ill when in fact they're not, and it does demeans the quality and care of an individual. So I'm not saying in support of or against right now. I just want to put that out there.
All right, thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Well, I guess I. Yep. Bob, you said you supported the amendment, and I wasn't sure which one. Is it both? Or
both amendments.
Both amendments.
Senator
okay,
Thatcher.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. So, Chuck, you're here. Chuck Sparks. Well, Chuck, why don't you come on up? I see C. Sparks, and I figure that seeing you on the front row, that had to be you. I'd like to have you. Harris, why don't you come up? And Gail, if you'll join them as well.
Chair Przanski, may I add Deputy DA Melissa Marrero?
Gail, if you'll sit down since you're kind of in the between.
I will defer until you'll have another hearing on this.
I'm not saying we're going to have another public hearing.
Okay.
We'll call you up after this. You can put stuff on the record. And I'm sorry. If you'll just give me your name, please.
Yes, Melissa Marrero.
Thank you. So, Chuck, I don't know if you want to start or Harris or Melissa, whoever.
Since Mr. Matarazzo has litigated extensively in this area, Chair Przanski, I would defer to Mr. Matarazzo.
Okay, thank you.
After him.
Thank you again, Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Harris Matarazzo. I'm an attorney who works extensively with individuals under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and also the Oregon Health Authority. I've also worked extensively, have had extensive background in doing appellate work, especially in the matter of what is and is not a mental disease or defect. In addition, since 1994, I've co-authored four editions of the Oregon State Bar's Criminal Law, Mental Illness and Incapacity chapter and have taught at the undergraduate, graduate, and the professional mental health level. Finally, I'm also on a certification committee for individuals seeking forensic certification to provide information to attorneys and the court as to whether or not an individual truly does have a mental disease or defect for purposes of Oregon law. I am opposed to this bill. I certainly understand that individuals may have misgivings about some of the terminology, but my fear is that it will change existing law. Any change, as the head of NAMI said to me, Harris, words matter, and they certainly do. To change the terms of the statute now would indicate to me, as an appellate attorney, that you had an intention different than existing law. Frankly, it's take after 40 years of developing case law and some statutory amendments enacted within recent years by the legislature, we believe the system is working well. One of the big fights that we had, and what took me in a 13-year battle with the PSRB, was whether or not the voluntary use of alcohol and non-prescribed drugs resulting in psychosis was a mental disease or defect, and whether sexual disorders were mental diseases or defects. The board held that they were. It took me 13 years and four trips to the Oregon Supreme Court and multiple trips to the Oregon Court of Appeals to finally get opinions which said, in fact, that the PSRB was acting against legislative intent. In fact, in 1983, they had gone before you and said that these are not mental diseases or defects and should be excluded, and that was granted. Unfortunately, the board refused to follow its own mandate, or the mandate that you had given it and the one that it had supported. I am very afraid that any change will, rather than lessen the use of the inappropriate use of the insanity defense, will in fact open it up again. In 2004, I believe, the PSRB had, I think, as many as 126 new clients. In other words, individuals found guilty except for insanity. With the two appellate decisions that I've cited, also a change in the statute which allowed for credentialing of psychologists and psychiatrists who do forensic evaluations for people who use the insanity defense, and also the creation of the Oregon Health Authority's taking of about, I think, 20% of PSRB cases, there has been a dramatic shift. In fact, for at least new clients, new appropriately placed clients, have the number has dropped to its lowest level in about maybe at least 17 years, at least 1999. And we attribute this to an organized effort by the appellate courts and by this body, the legislature, in helping us keep inappropriate placements out of the system. Having individuals with mental illness live with folks who are not mentally ill, who are alcoholics and drug addicts, or merely sex offenders is not appropriate, and it should be discouraged at all costs. I would also note that the board is proposing, or has proposed, that the board has also recently adopted new administrative rules. And one of the rules that caused me the most heartburn was the one that said a qualifying mental disease or defect includes a mental disease or defect that could be active as a result of a non-qualifying mental disease or defect. And, of course, non-qualifying mental diseases or defects include those identified by the Oregon Supreme Court and the Oregon Court of Appeals in Tharp and Beiswinger, meaning the sexual disorders and also the substance use disorders. As I read those, after doing lots of research on this over the years, it's my belief that the board has determined that the voluntary ingestion of alcohol or drugs resulting in or the activation of psychosis is a mental disease or defect. That rule is in opposite of the 2005 Oregon Supreme Court decision in Tharp. And again, that decision is based entirely upon the board's testimony before this legislature in 1983. I believe, if challenged on appeal currently, that rule would fail under current law. However, to change the statute as currently proposed in Senate Bill 64 would be to severely weaken that position. Giving the PSRB the sole authority to determine what is or is not a mental disease or defect or qualifying psychiatric developmental condition as proposed would be problematic, potentially inviting a far greater and inappropriate use of the insanity defense. those are my concerns, and I thank you for your audience.
All right, before we take questions, I'm going to go ahead and do the whole panel, and then we'll open up for questions. I know there will be some. Melissa or Chuck?
Chair Pruszynski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and present this morning, as well as Ms. Marrero, who is our mental health expert in the district attorney's office. We rely heavily upon her. She will also be available to answer questions. We have a number of concerns, and Mr. Matarazzo has very eloquently phrased a number of them. I want to start initially with the observation that...
Chuck, I'm not sure if I caught you, if you said your full name or not on the record.
My apologies. Charles Sparks. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney with Multnomah County.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's my understanding that Dash 1 and Dash 2 collectively have removed the PSRB's authority to essentially by rulemaking define what whatever the new language would be for mental disease or defect actually means. And that is a tremendous relief. We were very concerned about that. So I'll put that aside and address my remarks to the two remaining issues. Number one, when we look at Dash 1, it instead of going with the original enrolled version of qualifying psychiatric or developmental condition, it now substitutes disorder. But I am in complete agreement with Mr. Matarazzo. A good and careful lawyer will discern from any legislative change that change is meant, that the legislature has decided that something new and different is to be considered as an adequate foundation for guilty except for insanity. That is going to trigger litigation. That is going to trigger efforts to put people into the state hospital. And ultimately, the PSRB will decide on the back end whether that that condition or whatever you call it will qualify as something that will a sufficient condition to keep that individual under the board's jurisdiction. And to the extent that an individual is allowed to invoke GEI, on particularly new and different grounds at the trial level and then potentially be presented to the PSRB as a fait accompli, as a GEI, the PSRB, of course, has the independent obligation to determine whether, in fact, that individual qualifies as they see the law. And GEI then becomes potentially a door out onto the street with no supervision if the PSRB disagrees with a judicial interpretation of new statutory language. New statutory language will trigger litigation. That is the nature of our system, and obviously, Chair Pruszynski, being a prosecutor, you well understand that a good defense lawyer and some of the people I respect the most as lawyers are on the other side of cases I try. And it is their constitutional obligation to probe and to test any new language. And I'm afraid that's what's going to happen. People will be adjudicated GEI for new and different reasons. They'll be presented to the PSRB and either into a state hospital bed when the legislature didn't necessarily intend that, or potentially worse for public safety, out the door. The second concern is the Dash 2 language. Under current law, what I would call the combination effect, an individual who has a significant mental health condition but is not, that condition would not suffice to render him or her GEI because the condition is, for whatever reason, under sufficient control that individual is simply not going to qualify. You have people who are schizophrenic who are not GEI when they commit certain acts. But if you add, for example, methamphetamine on top of their circumstance, then they move into an area where they lose control and they commit certain acts. And under current law, that individual would not be able to invoke GEI. But under the proposed Dash 2, since the substance use or abuse would not be the sole cause for the individual's conduct, but instead a partial cause layered on top of the mental health condition, the Senate Bill 64-2 would allow that individual to invoke GEI, and that is not appropriate, and we're very much concerned about that. The I think those summarize my concerns, and thank you very much to the committee for hearing me out.
All right, Chuck, thank you very much. Melissa, did you also have some comments?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. No, I'm here for questions if you have any.
Got it. Appreciate you being here. So first let me ask if there's any questions for anyone on the panel. Senator Manning first, then I'll Senator Denbrough, then I will follow.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Two questions from the, from the previous testimony that was given, it seemed to be from a medical perspective. Yours seemed to be from a legal prosecutorial perspective. I'm kind of concerned about what is best for the patient. So I'm interested in learning more on both perspectives. Again, I haven't made my decision or in support of or opposed to any, but I am concerned about the medical perspective, you know, which is actually concerned about the treatment of the client instead of how do we prosecute someone for the crimes. I don't understand. What is the GEI? I'm sorry.
Senator Manning, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, my apologies. Guilty except for insanity. ORS 161295 defines that, and it is what we call colloquially the insanity defense. And my apologies for using an acronym. I should not have done that.
Thank you.
And may I, I would actually defer to Mr. Matarazzo, who has extensive expertise in the medical needs of patients, since those are the clients whom he represents, as to your first question.
Yes, thank you. well, it's important, although I said this to Mr. Sparks on occasion, he and I are seldom on the same side of the of an issue, but we are on this one. I agree with you 100% that people with mental health needs and requiring hospitalization need treatment and need appropriate treatment. And that, frankly, was one of the sort of the fires burning within me that took on the PSRB and its determination that drug and alcohol related disorders and sexual disorders were mental illnesses, because in fact those people were being maintained in the state hospital with people who were actually mentally ill. And frankly, it wasn't a good mix. Many of my clients were taken advantage of. The hospital was overflowing. As you know, the Oregon State Hospital was bursting at its seams at the time. It's getting back to that point now, I'm told, but it's not because of the GEI population. It's because of the aid and assist population. I think one of my sole purposes, one of my major purposes of being here today is to be sure we do not open that door again. I do not want, I mean, I work with the back door mostly, and that is getting people who want out from under PSRB out. But I fully come to realize over a period of time that it's the front door that must be maintained as well. If people slip in inappropriately in the system, PSRB has shown by history that they will keep them even if they are inappropriate, and that's the reason we had to go to court for 13 years. I don't want that to happen again. I don't think a change in the law, I think a change in the law will open up a horrible opportunity for inappropriate placements, which will again place people who are not mentally ill with those that are, and frankly, be, you know, work negatively.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes.
So there was a reference to drug addiction, alcoholism, which would not fall up under, or would you say that they do fall up under some type of mental incapacitation of an individual to make choices?
Well, it's really interesting. So, as you know, the voluntary intoxication is not a defense to criminal activity.
Mr. Matarazzo, just for your information, the only attorney that's sitting here is me, so everyone's going to know what the common understanding is within the in the profession.
Thank Mr. Chair, thank you. So one of the big fights that we had in the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court is regarding what is or is not a mental disorder. And it's like the mental health professionals have what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness. And basically that's like a big encyclopedia which lists all the criteria necessary to make various diagnoses. Under the board's interpretation of the law up until 2005, and I made this representation to the Oregon Supreme Court, there are all sorts of mental disorders listed, including homosexuality at one point in DSM. I think at DSM 2 or 3 was listed as a mental disorder. Caffeine intoxication, or caffeine abuse and dependence, nicotine abuse dependence. These kinds of things are listed within DSM as a mental disorder, or they have been over the years, and they that will wax and wane depending on the addition of DSM. Those kinds of disorders, really, although they are disorders and are listed or have been listed, are not conditions which should be which someone should be able to allow argue, frankly, constitute a mental illness or to maintain somebody in a state hospital based on that. I think that's kind of what it boils down to for me.
Chair Brzozinski, may I follow up?
Yes.
To also answer Senator Manning's question. Senator Manning, Chair Brzozinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. Your question also related to the concept or the idea that prosecution, just seemingly that we're concerned that we be able to prosecute people and that that's sort of the goal here in opposing this Dash 2 amendment or the Dash 1 amendment. And I would say that we are in complete agreement. Mr. Matarazzo is correct. We're not often on the same side of the case, but we're, I think, very much in agreement that it's about doing the right thing for each individual. The state has no business wanting someone who is truly GEI to be prosecuted for anything or to have any other outcome except GEI. So it's not about somehow defending the right to prosecute someone. It's simply acknowledging the fact that 45 years of this legislature's work in 1971 forward and 45 years of case law, good work by the judges around the state of Oregon and by both the defense and the prosecution to really define what the concepts mean behind mental disease or defect, that is what we're attempting to protect. We're very concerned that that will be swept away and that new combination effects, this is the Dash 2 concern, defendants who use drugs voluntarily, exacerbate their own pre-existing mental health situations, will then be able to come in and claim GEI when in fact under current law they cannot. And we are simply concerned not to open up more doors into the state hospital when in fact people do have to be responsible for their own conduct, which drug and alcohol use and abuse, that's exactly what they are. So we are understanding of the sensitivity, certainly, but we're very concerned about the implications of sweeping away 45 years of settled law. That being said, I think that if this legislature decides, along with this governor, to make this change, having a legislative history be extremely clear on the concept of changing the word disorder and the case law change in Dash 2 is extremely important. Although Dash 2 will trigger litigation and Dash 2 is fraught with problems even with a clear legislative history. Thank you.
And right, Senator Brzozinski, if
yes.
I may. Thank you, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senator Manning. This is, I think it's important.
Melissa, go ahead and put your name back on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Melissa Marrero from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
Thank you.
I think it's also important for the panel to know that if somebody is adjudicated guilty except for insanity, based on evaluations, based on the information that we have, and if there is uncertainty in the definition of what constitutes a mental disorder or a mental disease or defect or whatever language we're using at the time, once that person is sent to the state hospital and once that person is committed to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, we can't go and undo that if a later court tells us that our interpretation was incorrect and that a mental disorder, in fact, does not qualify as an appropriate condition to have a person be before the PSRB. And so for public safety concerns as well, it's not just the litigation that will be potentially increased, and it's not just the doors of the state hospital that will be potentially opened wider. It's a public safety concern because many of the individuals who we're talking about have committed very dangerous crimes. Some have committed minor crimes all the way up to murder and aggravated murder. And when we're talking about these sorts of individuals who really do need some sort of supervision or some sort of safety planning and control within the community, our inability to go back and relitigate or come up with an alternate plan, our inability to do that creates immense public safety concerns. So knowing where we stand in terms of what is a qualifying disorder is very, very important, not just for the interests that have already been discussed, but for public safety as well.
All right, thank you. Senator Dimbrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first is kind of following up on this line. The legislature frequently makes changes in order to get rid of language that it's deemed obsolete or offensive, you know, that once made sense but no longer does. And, you know, this seems that the Dash One Amendment seems to fall into that category. This is, you know, the term defect, you know, is considered offensive now. And we want to substitute disorder for disease or defect. But I don't think we want to change anything other than that. That is, disorder equals what was disease or defect. So I appreciate the concern about it raising ambiguity. And is it an adequate solution to that concern for us to just be very clear every step of the way that that is our sole intent in making this change, that is, in this committee, on the floor, et cetera? Would that satisfy? Because this is, you know, as I say, something we have to do a lot, change language that way.
Senator Dimbrough, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, that will certainly help. And that is critically important. And I think you've used also an important modifier every step of the way that that be said. We're very concerned. Mr. Matarazzo and I have both experienced this, and Ms. Marrero is earlier in her career experiencing it, but is also experiencing the very same thing, which is any change that the legislature makes will presume to have meaning, be presumed to have meaning. And as Mr. Matarazzo very clearly said, words matter. So it is not a desire to hold on to antiquated language that is, for clear reasons, seems to be insulting, but instead to affect the important work that the legislature has done and the courts have done in the last 45 years. One of the concerns is, in reading up on this, reference was made to something called a tautological treadmill, where tomorrow, 5 years from now, disorder will be the disfavored term and there will be an effort to change. And then any case law that's developed, and there will be case law that develops under the word disorder, will then be swept away potentially for the very same reasons, and we'll be back at square one. Protecting the public and giving certainty to individuals who are charged with crime and their counsel and judges and district attorneys around the state is very important. The law needs to be, whenever possible, settled and predictable, and I don't need to lecture this committee on that because that's what you do. But that is the concern, Senator Dimbrough.
And if I may add, the term mental disorder is a term of art, DSM. Frankly, all the diagnoses listed in DSM are mental disorders. And one of the big arguments I had with the PSRB over that 13-year period of trying to determine what was and was not a mental disease or defect, the board kept arguing that, in fact, mental disorder, as a term of art, reflected that only terms reflected that the legislature adopted DSM as sort of the Bible as to, you know, what was and was not a mental disorder. In fact, that was not the case. The legislative history showed specifically that DSM was not involved. So I think to use the word mental disorder, frankly, would not be good either. I think it would, again, as a term of art, the appellate courts, as they did in at least one of my cases when they sort of sidestepped the issue, is to say that's we frequently rely on the DSM in making these determinations. DSM does not, you know, does not sustain your position, Mr. Matarazzo. And in fact, the legislative history showed later, when I really dug into it, that DSM was not, you know, the use of DSM was not reflected in defining the term. I would also like to note that there is certainly a human cost, and history tells us what the human cost of inappropriate placements under the PSRB have been. Individuals who were placed under PSRB who were not mentally ill but had just sexual disorders and substance abuse disorders were not deemed the PSRB has the ability to put people out on conditional release, which is like a very strict parole or probation if they're doing well in the hospital. The PSRB was refusing to discharge people based on those diagnoses, saying that they were mental illnesses. But the mental health community, which would normally accept these folks on conditional release in the community, was refusing to accept them as well because these folks did not have a mental disease or defect, and so because they weren't mentally ill. And so there's a human cost. People remained in the hospital for years that didn't need to be there at a cost now of about $25,000 a month. There was suffering of the people that were there. There was suffering of their peers who were mentally ill, who were subjective to inappropriate behaviors.
And, Ms. Marzal, I appreciate historical perspective.
Yes.
I have other people need to testify. I have a couple other things. And I have some questions. Senator Dimbrough, do you have a follow-up?
I did, if I could. Just now with the Dash 2 amendments. You know, as I read this, the change in 2A, just a plain reading of it, says it's trying to clarify that mental disease or defect or disorder does not include an abnormality consisting solely of da-da-da-da-da. And that it seems to me that the board would still need to show that underlying, the underlying disorder or illness was there, and these are just kind of partial, maybe in some cases provoking in the case of substance withdrawal. So it's hard for me. It's hard for me to see that this is doing anything other than really clarifying that you can't base the decision on any of these considerations. They may be present, but just the fact that they're present doesn't really have anything to do with anything. And that's how I read the word solely there. And so, I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions for how this intent, I think, could be worded more clearly in a way that, gets at the concern that you feel.
Let me interject here. The chair's prerogative on this is going to be having a small work group to see what, if anything, I'm going to say that again, what, if anything, is going to move forward. So we're going to have some time to let that type of detail be discussed and observed. This is very complex. This is one of those areas that we're just not going to rush into anything, and we're going to make certain we do it right the first time, the best we can, and we're taking all those considerations, but it's a very good point. So any other questions on this end? All right, so let me just go through a couple of things. Mr. Matarazzo, your testimony that you handed in for 64, was that based on the original bill? Or because I did not see any reference to the Dash 1s and Dash 2s. I just want to make sure we have the record correct.
Yeah, that was based on the original bill, but I believe it also includes.
As has been discussed, I do want to have a work group to kind of look at this, and Josh will be heading it up. What I do want to put on the record is that if we're going to make a change, specifically on the name or identifying, we will include, and I know Legislative Council is going to hate me for this, but we're going to put a preamble in there. So we'll work through that through the work group. The preamble will basically say whatever changes we're making has absolutely no impact on existing case law or the intent of the existing statutory law that was codified. So we make it very clear, and that way it's going to, I think, even narrow those chances for people trying to read the intent, because it's going to be actually in the bill. Now, again, LC's not going to like it, but I think these are the type of situations that call for that potential. For my clarification, are we in the DSM 3 or 4? What is the number we're now?
Five.
Five? You shows you how long it's been since I did that work. All right. And then my understanding is that currently under the 5, that does not, it still uses the terms mental disease and disorder?
Just mental disorder.
Mental disorders.
Yeah.
All right, and that's another point I just want to put on the record, because to me, I want to do, I have no problem making these type of word changes to get more in line with what's appropriate in language and not misidentify somebody. But at the same time, I'm curious as to if we have a professional treatise that basically uses those terms, how does that work in? So that's something else. So questions on this end?
I think the direction you're going makes sense. I understand the issue, and the Dash 2 amendment is the amendment that really sounds like it doesn't clarify what we're wanting it to clarify, even coming down to Section A, manifested only by repeated criminal, and then there's this really vague phrase, or otherwise antisocial conduct, and that sounds like a garage door big enough to drive a semi through. And so I wasn't sure in terms of clarifying what did we actually gain by putting that there.
Right, and I agree with your analysis. And to me, I guess based on what I've heard so far, what I'm hearing from the committee, the Dash 1s probably have a better chance of moving forward. The Dash 2s definitely need to work on there, because to me, we could be potentially having effects that we are very concerned with as to already going through and identifying certain type of conditions not to be the predicate for mental disorder. Any other comments? I'm going to go ahead and let Gail come up and put a couple things on the record. Just remember, Kel, we are going to do a work group. You will be part of the work group since you're representing the association. And Chuck or Melissa, if one of the two of you could be available, that would be great. And I'll have Josh coordinate to see. It's going to be very small, 3 or 4 people, and we'll have the agency, you know, sitting in as well.
We would be delighted, Chair Pozanski. Thank you. And I will, with the chair's permission, perhaps submit a revised version of what was going to be my written testimony, just a short document, but with Dash 1 and Dash 2 and role changing, that'll be changed as well.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So as Gail's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on SB 64?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for assuring that there will be a work group going forward. I just want to say that there was a meeting back in January 12th. All the stakeholders were present, and so by that I mean DOJ, appellate, PSRB, OCDLA, the DAs. There was consensus in the room that the phrase mental disease or defect needed to change. It was just too antiquated, too insulting. And there was also agreement in the room that the bill would not go further than existing statute and existing interpretation of law. So there was agreement on that, and you're absolutely right, words matter desperately here in a moment like this, but there is agreement that something needs to change, and that but it shouldn't go further than existing law is right now today. So with that, we're looking forward to the work group and the continued discussions. We hope to be helpful.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Gail? If not, I'm gonna go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 64. I have two members that are here on Senate Bill 247, and so I'm gonna go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 247. We'll come back to SB 65. So we now have 247 up, and Josh, if you give us a quick overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 247 renames deviant sexual intercourse.
John first, John second.
I thought you said John, not Josh.
The bill renames deviant sexual intercourse as oral or anal sexual intercourse for purposes of the Oregon Criminal Code. We do, in fact, have the impact statements. There is no fiscal or revenue impact. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski and committee. John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. A little hard of hearing this morning. Please indulge me. Not sure why. I am the co-convener with Senator Kathleen Taylor of the Trafficking Work Group. We have held that position since Representative Carolyn Tomei retired a couple of years ago. And Senate Bill 247 is going to be It's probably the easiest bill for the session, so we're starting off with the low-hanging fruit. Although based on the language cleanup that we just heard the testimony on, I'm almost afraid to say that it's a simple bill, so I won't go there. But this is the first of seven bills that we're going to have, three of them in the Senate, and two of them will start in the House from our trafficking work group. And like I say, this is a language cleanup that hopefully will go smoothly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator?
Okay. Hello, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, Senate District 21. Representative Huffman and I co-chair the statewide CSEC, Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Work Group, and this is the first bill our work group is bringing forward this session. Senate Bill 247 updates language in the Oregon Criminal Code and the law to replace the term deviant sexual intercourse with oral and anal sexual intercourse. The need to make this change to the Oregon Criminal Code was brought to our attention by the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office in 2015. To explain the language change in Senate Bill 247, I'm going to read from testimony provided by Oregon District Attorney's Association, submitted by Multnomah County ADA J.R. Yuju Fusu. I'm sorry, I know him pretty well, and I'm sorry he couldn't be here today. So I'm going to go ahead and read from a letter he sent to us. Presently, ORS 163.305.1 defines deviant sexual intercourse as sexual conduct between persons consisting of contact between the sex organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another. Deviant is defined by Merriam-Webster Dictionary as to stray especially from a standard principle or topic, to depart from an established course or norm. In addition, Merriam-Webster explains that deviant and deviant share a common Latin root. The association to the word deviant and negative connotation of the word deviant is common. Senate Bill 247 is written to simply change the name and title of the sexual acts defined in ORS 163.305.1 from deviant sexual intercourse to oral and anal sexual intercourse without changing the rights, laws, or penalties associated with the prescribed crimes. In addition, the intent of the bill is not to alter case law definitions or meanings, rather to simply rename sex acts that under certain circumstances are prohibited by Oregon law. In many instances within the criminal justice system, the use of the word quote-unquote deviant to describe sex acts has offended individuals. These individuals range from grand jurors to victims. The bill simply changes the title to describe in a neutral manner the sex acts, oral or anal sexual intercourse. This is consistent with other statutes and titles within the Oregon Revised Statutes as well as other states. Thank you, members of the committee and chair, and I appreciate your time, and I hope you support Senate Bill 247.
Thank you. Questions for either on the panel?
The
Senator Lethicombe.
Yeah, excuse me.
You're fine.
Thank you. There's an interesting item here. You're going through and just changing the wording, and I recognize that is. But as we come across Section 8, there's a phrase in there that says, with an unmarried person under 18 years of age. And I'm wondering why the married unmarried at the bottom of this document, sexual misconduct or sexual, let's see, what does it actually say? It says sexual contact means something of sexual organs other than intimate parts of a person not married to the actor. That Section 8 seems to me like it ought to have a not married to the actor clause to it versus simply an unmarried phrase that's in there. I don't know that in your language update you want to touch that section, but that section looks like a giant loophole to me. It's married versus unmarried versus relating to the actor or not.
I'm going to go... Josh, committee staff, do you have something to add to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Lethicombe, I think that's an absolutely fair point. I would just note that this statute has been unamended since 1971, so I think it came in with that unmarried language and hasn't been touched since then. I don't know necessarily whether this is the right vehicle to address that issue, but I think it's an absolutely fair legal point.
Great. I don't know that this is the right place either, but just since you're combing through this, there's an item that I think is worth noting.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Lincoln, good point. We'll check with JR. I did want to point out for the new members,
you know, who comprises the trafficking work group, just so you don't think it's just the two of us, that Aaron Knott from DOJ is assigned to the work group. Chana Newell does the staffing for the work group. J.R. Ujifusa from the Multnomah County DA's office is a regular attender. Justice David Brewer is a part of the work group. So we've got quite a few people that pre-vet these bills, and I just wanted to get that on the record so that Senator Linthicum and Senator Manning might understand kind of, you know, who is on the work group.
Yeah, John, thank you very much for doing that. I think that's a good point to put out on and on the record. We will look at the concern that's raised. It looks like the relating clause may fit, that we can make some of the changes. But again, we'll, before we start doing that, we'll make sure we got everyone in the work group has an opportunity to weigh in on that. All right, any other questions for the panel? All right, Gail, I had you down, also wanting to speak in favor.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, Mary Sell here. I'll actually speak on the bill.
All right, so Mary, why don't you come up. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 247? Mary, when you're ready, give us your name and your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am a public defender. I am actually a legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. That's why I'm here at the table this morning. We are simply here to offer our support of Senate Bill 247. The senator and representative said before me, this is really just a language cleanup. I was sitting through the other hearing, and so I understand that sometimes that can be more complicated. But essentially for us, the reason why we're offering support is anytime we can clarify things for our clients, for the jury, is positive. And so in this case, essentially what's happening is the language is, instead of being defined in the statute, is just coming to the forefront, and it's going to be much clearer. So anytime we can add clarity, it's going to be helpful for not just clients, but the grand jury, jurors in trial, and victims. And so that's pretty much all I have to say, and I just wanted to offer that support.
All right, Mary, thank you. Any questions for her? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you so much for your time.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 247. Even though we have the paperwork ready to move this, I think it is something that we just want to check it before we take the next step on it, see what, if anything, we want to make as a modification on the part that came forward. So Josh will coordinate on that. With that, we're going to go back up and do our public hearing on Senate Bill 65. Josh, if you'll give us an overview, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 65 authorizes the Psychiatric Security Review Board to develop a restorative justice program to assist the recovery of crime victims. The bill provides that documents or communications used in the program are confidential, are inadmissible in administrative and judicial proceedings, and do not constitute public records. Senate Bill 65 also authorizes the PSRB to adopt rules to carry out the program and describe the circumstances when the records may be disclosed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, so the only person I have on my sheet is Harris. And Harris, I'm not sure, are you going to be for or against?
I'm against.
All right, and then Juliet or Sid, are you speaking on behalf of the board and the bill? Come on up. And Harris, why don't you go ahead and come on up? I think just the two of you are going to be it. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 65? All right, Juliet, if you'll give us your name and start us off, please.
Good morning, Chairman Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senators of the Committee. My name is Juliet Britton. I'm Director of the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board. In an effort to expand our services to victims of crimes committed by those under PSRB supervision, Senate Bill 65 would allow the PSRB to stand up a restorative justice, or RJ program, as we call it. Establishment of an RJ program is already within the board's current statutory authority through its ability to give victims the allowance to be heard. However, the board is looking for some statutory privacy protection to ensure that those who might participate in a restorative justice program know that that process will not be open to the public and will remain confidential. The primary focus of restorative justice is to address the needs of those most affected by the harm, as opposed to punishment of the person who offended. Nationwide surveys of victims and survivors routinely show that victims are not satisfied when they participate in the traditional criminal justice process. Restorative justice is a way that victims can initiate a confidential and private facilitated dialogue between the person that they have been offended against and themselves. Restorative justice has existed in many, many countries, thousands of programs throughout the state. It's used in the juvenile justice system, schools, neighborhood associations, and even here in Oregon at the Department of Corrections. Surveys have revealed that victims, there's a very high rate of victim satisfaction in a restorative justice program. It allows fewer people to struggle with the aftermath of crime. Victims can become survivors, and PSRB clients can move forward in their own recovery by contributing meaningfulness to the process. In 2015, the board created a Restorative Justice Advisory Council to explore whether the PSRB should stand up a program and whether or not it made sense in a forensic psychiatric setting to have a restorative justice program. In December 2016, the council submitted its recommendations to the board. Of those recommendations, it was very clear that there was some sort of privacy statutory protection that was recommended, and that's why we created or proposed Senate Bill 65. The hope is that once this privacy protection is in place, then we will look for an outside agency, probably a university that has a psychology department, to actually run the program and allow victims and individuals under our supervision to move forward with their recovery. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I think what I'm going to go ahead and do is, Harris, I'll let you go ahead and give your testimony, and then we'll open up for questions. My only request, seeing that you have written testimony here, please don't read the entirety of your written testimony because it's already part of the record. If you'll summarize that or give us other highlights.
I will. Thank you for that opportunity, Chairman Przanski. So I've already described my background, and it's in my written testimony, so I won't go through that. As I oppose this particular bill, not because I oppose restorative justice. In fact, I don't think you can do what I do and see the sometimes the carnage that results from people who do engage in illegal conduct.
Harris, I do need to put your full name on the record. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yeah. Again, my name is Harris Matarazzo, Matarazzo. I'm an attorney, and I specialize in working with individuals who have been found guilty except for insanity and are under PSRB jurisdiction or the jurisdiction of the Oregon Health Authority. As I mentioned, I am opposed to this particular bill, but I am not opposed to restorative justice. I'm a big proponent of restorative justice. My concern here is that the PSRB is an inappropriate agency to oversee it. As noted, a task force was appointed, and our first three meetings, in each one, the task force was asked, do you support this? Should we move forward? And there was no support for it. Finally, at the third meeting, it was asked whether somebody who would like to take this over. And I agreed to take it over. My office invested significant time and frankly, money into exploring what is a restorative justice program and how would it best work. Nobody in our office nor in the PSRB office, at least to my knowledge when I asked, had any training in restorative justice or any certification, for example, any certification. So we began an extensive survey into the problem or into the issue, and we discovered, first of all, that there is no such program that we could find for people with mental health issues who have been found guilty except for insanity. So this would be something new and potentially very exciting. We did discover, though, a few issues. One, as Ms. Britton discussed, and that's confidentiality. We find this to be very problematic for the PSRB to run a program like this, but also keep it separate from board members and confidential so it doesn't bleed over, frankly, into PSRB hearings. Victims are allowed to make victim impact statements. One of the concerns from a defense perspective is that things said in a restorative justice program that could be used in a PSRB setting, negatively used in a PSRB setting to change the outcome of a hearing could happen. And that's very different from the restorative justice model, which says, for example, in the prison setting where somebody is found guilty, the judge has established their sentence, and then the inmate decides and the victim decide to meet to engage in restorative justice. The inmate gets no positive there's no benefit from it except the benefit itself, and that's engaging restorative justice. In this situation, frankly, there's a certain kind of a coercion that could go on, maybe coercing somebody who may be, frankly, mentally fragile to engage in a process that would not, which would be detrimental to them, or feeling they had to because the board would find out if they didn't, or, for example, in a victim impact statement where the victim wanted to do it but the client didn't want to do it. We want to eliminate all that from PSRB oversight, and we don't think that, frankly, there could be enough confidentiality to allow that to happen. We just don't see it because board staff would be involved both on the restorative justice and also at the hearings part. We did suggest some options, though. Our small task force suggested some options. There are two programs that are there. We suggested four options. Two of them are already in place. One is the Oregon State Hospital, which has been running essentially a restorative justice program for years, and that's called treatment. The hospital, because especially with family members, when individuals, my clients, who offend against family, for example, they can be brought together and counseling can be done. It's very appropriate. They know the clients. They know which ones are fragile, which ones aren't. They can do screening. They can establish trusting relationships with them. I mean, it's all there and it all works. Sometimes this has even occurred with non-family members, in my experience. Sometimes restorative justice can include a letter bank where a client, for example, has killed somebody and wants to make amends, or there's a no contact order where the client will actually begin writing letters of amendment of amends that are banked by the hospital and, of course, never sent. So these things are already in place, and frankly, we think that's a better alternative than the PSRB, establishing a new program for PSRB to oversee. Another program that's already in existence involves the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections already has this, and as you know, the Department of Corrections is the largest provider of mental health treatment in the state of Oregon. I don't know why, frankly, that the Department of Corrections couldn't oversee this kind of a program as well. To have the PSRB do it, besides the concerns I have about how it could potentially bleed over into PSRB hearings and release, the other concern I have is that just of cost. Why would the legislature establish a new program and there are going to be costs when, in fact, other public programs already exist? So for those reasons, we oppose it. Again, I would also note that this program, the board often cites one case where restorative justice was used. Yes, it was used. It really didn't involve the board. The beating happened after a board hearing. It was well sort of choreographed with all the individuals. So for those reasons, we oppose it. Only the PSRB running the program. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate your comments. Any questions? All right, we're going to hold off on anything else on this one for now. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming forward. Thank you very much for your testimony and your time. We're going to go ahead and go up to our continuation of our informational meeting that we had from last week. We have Michael Schmidt back here. Mike's going to give us a little continuation on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. So we'll open up the informational hearing to continue that. And, Mike, based on the time you've got, just about 10 minutes or so of time. I need to let members have enough time to get back to their offices for their 10 o'clocks.
Okay, Chair Przewanski, Co-Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me back to continue this presentation. This will be very brief, but what I hope to do, you kind of saw at the first, my name is Mike Schmidt, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. What we went over the first time through the PowerPoint was kind of the two spheres of influence that the Criminal Justice Commission operates in. There's the grant programs that we fund and operate and oversee, and then there's the research side of the shop. What I wanted to take just a few more minutes of your time to show you today is hopefully useful to this committee and you as you do your work. Some of the tools that we've created that we're hoping make the criminal justice system more transparent and more accessible and allow people to make decisions based on data and facts and are available to everybody. So I'll start off by showing you the criminal justice interactive dashboards. So this is, if you go to our homepage, the Criminal Justice Commission, you can click on interactive dashboards. It's one of your options. And it brings you to this page where we have posted multiple different types of dashboards that are looking at various aspects of our criminal justice system. And I just wanted to kind of show you how these work so you can kind of get the thing. So I'll show you recidivism. I think that's a good dashboard, but we do prison usage. We look at our short-term transitional leave program. So there are all kinds of different aspects that we're looking at in the Oregon criminal justice system. But just to give you an idea of how this works, you can see that this front page, and it's a little bit cut off the screen, but if you had it in front of you on your own desktop, you'd be able to see the whole thing. But it allows you to go through and click on, this is all Oregon-specific data. This is the overview of recidivism rates of the parole population and of the probation population. And it's all completely interactive. So for example, if you click here on arrests, you can see that the average time for somebody who recidivates with a new arrest event in 3 years is 10.4 months for the parole population. And for the probation population, it's 10.7 months. So this just kind of gives you high-level information that you can go through and look at and compare the parole recidivism rates versus probation. And down below, you can see race split out, risk level split out, so you can see how that all plays out with arrests, convictions, and incarceration, which is the definition of recidivism in Oregon, is one of those events in 3 years. So just high-level information, statewide data. But then you can even go to the next panel here, and this allows you to go county by county and statewide on recidivism rates. So over here you can kind of scroll and see how far back you want to go. We go back to 1997, I believe. You can look at certain age groups if you wanted to break it out by certain age groups. You all are probably familiar that younger, that kind of 18 to 30-year-old group is more likely to recidivate. And then as you get older, you get less likely. So if you wanted to isolate that, you could. You can look at just parole or probation. You can look at certain types of crime. So if you had legislation in front of you that was targeting a certain type of program for a certain type of crime, you could go on here and see what the recidivism rates for people who commit those types of crimes are. Gender, there's been a lot of conversation so far in this session already about our female prison population. So if you were, for example, as senators, looking at programs that would impact the female population, you could go on here and look at recidivism rates just based on that alone. So we hope it really kind of gives both yourselves, lawmakers, but also local public safety policy folks tools and information to kind of track their own progress over time. So what you can see to the right here is these are the actual recidivism rates of the state of Oregon for, I haven't selected any one specific subgroup, so this is everybody. And so the top line is the arrest rate. The middle line is the conviction rate, and then the bottom line is incarceration, meaning prison. And so you can just see those three lines and how they interact with each other. And then I'll pick the county that we're in right now, Marion County. And what that does is down below, it does the exact same breakout. So you can see the region that Marion County's in and how they compare specifically to the region and how they compare to the state, and how Marion County themselves do as just a county system. So if you are a local policymaker or you're a public safety official in Marion County, you can go on here and track your specific recidivism rates by crime, by gender. And this is crucial for example, we do a lot of work with justice reinvestment where counties are making resource allocations into programs that are targeting specific groups, property and drug offenders, and maybe even, you know, female offenders. So now with this tool, a county can actually go on and in pretty much real time track their recidivism rates for investments that they're making over time. So, you know, like I said at the outset, our goal is to both add transparency to the criminal justice system, but also to give data and information back to policymakers. So I hope that this can be a useful tool, not only for those folks, but for folks like yourselves who are looking at high-level policy issues. So this is just a sample of our interactive dashboards. You can all go on here and find your jurisdictions and participate in the conversations that are happening. And we break it out all different kinds of ways. And I'd be happy to spend any additional time with any of you individually to kind of go through the different offerings that we have. But I wanted to just spend the balance of my time talking about a different project that the Criminal Justice Commission has worked on in partnership with DPSST. It's called the Oregon Knowledge Bank. Probably all of you have had the experience of going to a great conference where you hear tons of great ideas, and then you go back home to your jurisdiction and you want to share those ideas, and you might remember one or two of those high-level things, right? Well, that kind of experience is where the Knowledge Bank was born out of. In Oregon, every single day, jurisdictions all over the state have innovative and great ideas to approach different public safety issues that are facing them. And even though we'd have conferences or networking events where people could share that information, a lot of it ends up getting lost. So with the Knowledge Bank, what we've done is we invite local jurisdictions, law enforcement agencies, to post on this Oregon-specific website what are the programs that they're doing that works, with the idea that other agencies from around the state can then navigate this and search and find, if they have a similar issue, what is working in other jurisdictions in Oregon. So I'll just give you a very quick run-through of this. By the way, this is a first-of-its-kind resource nationally that we are aware of, and in fact, multiple jurisdictions are contacting Oregon for the work that we've done here and are trying to copy this. So we're really proud of it and very excited.
Have you supplied us with the URLs? I didn't see it in the meeting materials.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lithgow, I believe they are in the PowerPoint that I presented to the committee the first time.
Okay.
But if not, I'll follow up with counsel and make sure you have those.
Can you link from CJC?
You can link from CJC, yep. And also Googling Oregon CJC or Oregon Knowledge Bank, it's the top hit for both. So this is how this website works. I'll click on policing programs. And so let's say that you're a police officer in a jurisdiction and you have issues with abandoned properties, right? So you go on here and you're wondering what else is happening in Oregon that people deal with this. So you click on abandoned properties. And here are four different programs of things that have been submitted to us from law enforcement agencies about how they enforce or how they are approaching this issue. So I'll click on the Yamhill Street Vacant Property Project. And what this does is it just gives you really high-level information. So it gives you what is, you know, it's like just the facts, right? It's old-school reporting. What was the problem you were trying to address? What is the solution that you've come up with? What outcomes have you seen? And then any kind of details and advice that you have for others. And it immediately links you to the officer who is in charge of that program, so you can reach out to them directly and ask them more detailed questions about if you wanted to set this up in your jurisdiction. And it gives you, there's their email right there. You click on it and go straight to that officer. It gives you other similar posts. So maybe this isn't exactly what you're looking for, but it's in the right direction. You can click on a different one and immediately see a different type of program. And maybe this is closer to what you're searching for. So the idea is just sharing information. It's just getting information out there among other officers, other agencies that are approaching this problem. We know we have innovative solutions all over Oregon on and very similar things that agencies are facing, and it's just kind of getting those people together. The other side of this, so we have the program side, and like I said, all of these programs are submitted to our agency. So this is user-generated content. We're not going out there and surveying Oregon. This is when people have a good idea in their local jurisdiction, they submit it to us. It takes 10 minutes or so to fill out the form, and we get it up on our website. The other thing that we have here is research. We have Oregon-specific research. So let's say that you want to do a criminal justice program, but you know, a lot of times the research that's available, or when you go to Google, right, is what worked for the NYPD or the LAPD. Well, that might not be extremely useful to you know, Salem Police Department. I mean, just because it works for NYPD doesn't mean it's going to work here. So what we have here is research that's been done in Oregon. And this is actually pretty work intensive for both CJC and DPSST because we are analyzing that research and trying to put it at a high level. But again, it's a completely searchable database. So let's say you wanted to find about any Oregon research on driving under the influence. Well, you can click it right here. And we do the high-level synopsis, but we cite to the entire article. So if you wanted to go deeper, you could do that. But we try to summarize it for you because, again, this is for practitioners in the field who are trying to do programs that work in their local jurisdiction.
Mike, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up because I'm going to let everyone out. So I wanted Mike to come back and just, let's say, give the teaser here. They will spend as much time as you have to help you understand this. This is cutting-edge work, as he said. I mean, it's nationally recognized as to on the Knowledge Bank. And then when you look at the dashboards, I can assure you, as it was when I came into office having three telephone lines and one IBM memory typewriter, we've gone way beyond that. There's this thing called the World Wide Web that they've started to use, and it's really just amazing what we've done and how this is really tracking us as one of the national leaders. And I just want him to have an opportunity. So I'm sorry to cut this short, but I want to make sure everyone can get back to their other obligations. And also for our members, if you have other obligations and you feel like you need to leave, please do not feel offended or offending me as a chair or anyone else if you need to do other things that cause you to leave early. With that, we're going to be adjourned till tomorrow, and I believe we're coming in at 8:15 is what the time is supposed to be.
I think that's right.
All right, that's what we're going on. Thank you.